AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, Brett Johnson with you here on a Tuesday afternoon, as today we're joined by Patrick Coulican, who is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer, great resource for the latest in Minnesota news and politics over at minnesotareformer.com. Today on the agenda, we are going to be talking about Patrick's column on Matt Burke and how the Walls campaign might need to be a little bit more bold in terms of trying to make sure they win this fall. We'll also be talking about new campaign finance numbers and nurses voting at the Mayo Clinic to decertify their union. Patrick, thanks so much for joining me on the show today.
Always a pleasure, Brett.
Absolutely. So let's start off with your column titled, "The Sacking of Matt Burke Won't Last Forever, So Walls Needs to Be Bold." And in your column, you bring up how Burke has made, well, no shortage of really abhorrent quotes over the past few weeks and months, including one back in June where he said, quote, "Our culture loudly but also stealthily promotes abortion. They're telling women they should look a certain way. They should have careers, all these things," unquote. So certainly there's no shortage of bad quotes from Matt Burke. But you bring up the very good point that the Walls campaign can't just rely on Matt Burke gaffes to win this fall, because Matt Burke's running mate, Scott Jensen, is a very skilled campaigner and has a good chance of winning this fall. So what challenges could the Walls campaign be facing in the coming months and weeks that could be trouble for that campaign, where they just aren't going to be allowed to rely on these gaffes from the Burke campaign?
Yeah, I mean, what kind of motivated me to write this was a lot of the snickering that I was hearing from people in my own kind of social and political circles here in the Twin Cities. And whenever people around me are all in kind of agreement, that's when I start to get nervous. and they were, of course, snickering over some of these Burke comments. And then later in the week, a couple of restaurants that had something called the Matt Burke Burger took his name off the menu, and it seemed like, wow, this was a ticket of Jensen and Burke was just such an easy one for Tim Walz to topple in the fall. And I just don't think that's the right attitude going into the fall. When your own president in the White House is, his approval numbers are in the 30s. And when your own record, speaking now of Governor Tim Walz, has been one crisis after another, I'm not going to say that they're of his own making or that this is his own fault. But if you look back at the last 4 years with a pandemic and an increase in crime and now inflation, this is not the kind of political environment that you want to be complacent about if you're Tim Walz and the Democrats. And I don't think it's good enough to just rely on the Matt Burke's abortion extremism or Scott Jensen's vaccine and COVID extremism, because it's very possible this campaign will be refocused in the fall on issues that are much less friendly to Governor Walz, and that is inflation and crime.
Yeah, absolutely. It kind of reminds me back to the summer of 2016, where a lot of people thought, well, look at Donald Trump making all these gaffes on the campaign. Hillary Clinton is leading by the polls and a lot over that summer. And then all of a sudden, lo and behold, Election Day, the race tightens and Trump ends up winning. So there are some parallels there where you can't just rely on the gaffes from your opponents. But in your column, you also bring up some things that Walz could be doing that could improve his standing for this fall, including calling a special session. Go into a little bit more in terms of what the Walz campaign could be doing to help themselves out for this fall.
Yeah, only the governor can call a special session. And we ended the legislative session in May without any kind of a deal, and so there's a big surplus. So what Walz could do is call a special session and say, lawmakers, you need to come back to St. Paul, and you need to help Minnesotans who are struggling with rising costs, especially food and energy. There's enough there to give every family $2,000. The conventional wisdom is the Republicans won't go along with it because they don't want a one-time payment to taxpayers. What they want is a permanent tax cut. And they also feel like they want to wait until they have potentially a Republican House and Senate next year, and who knows, maybe even Republican governor, and then that way they can use the surplus however they want. But I think that's going to be, it would be tough for Republicans to say, no, we're not going to give every Minnesota family $2,000. I don't think that's a good message for them going into the fall. But if they decide to say no, well, that's okay. Then that's a great issue for Walz to run on. And being that he's the governor, he's going to be the one, he's the one with the bigger megaphone, and he can really, I think, frame the entire election around the fact that to no fault of his own, inflation is at a 40-year high, and he wants to do something about it. He wants to give Minnesota families $2,000, and Republicans don't. So I don't know. I think there's something to be said for that tactic, but I don't really – I actually don't think they're going to do it because it's just riskier. And the conventional wisdom is you never call back the legislature unless you've got an agreement in writing ahead of time. And that's because once they're in session, they can do whatever they want. And so you don't want to lose control like that. But I think the reality is this year that Republicans don't want to be, the Republican-led Senate doesn't want to be in session because it's just going to point to the fact that it can't get anything done and that they're saying no to $2,000 for every Minnesota family. So we'll see. We'll see what they do. But I suspect that Walz is going to take the risk-averse approach.
And speaking of that race between Walz and Jensen, let's go into some campaign finance numbers that were out this week. And they show that Walz has $5 million of cash on hand compared to Scott Jensen, who only has $581,000 of money on hand. So I'm curious what your take is on these numbers, because that's a pretty big advantage for the Walz campaign, especially being that they already have a number of ad reservations placed on TV and radio stations this fall, while I believe the Jensen campaign still has yet to make any of those reservations. What do you make of these numbers so far? Could they change if more national groups get involved, or is this largely going to be a campaign where Walz is going to have the cash and advertising advantage?
I think there's no question he's going to have an advantage. The question is whether or not outside groups, and especially the Republican Governors Association, is willing to come in and help Jensen. And I think to do that, they're going to have to show evidence that, that Jensen's making some progress, both on the fundraising front and in the polls. But it does look like Walz has been extremely prodigious in his fundraising, and certainly he's going to have the money to blanket the airwaves later in this race. And there's an argument to be made that he ought to be defining Jensen right now before Jensen has the cash to respond. The counter argument to that is, well, nobody knows who Scott Jensen is. I mean, his name recognition statewide is still not that big. So why would you elevate him and essentially pay to have his name recognition increase. So that, I'm sure that's an interesting discussion within the Walz campaign. But big cash advantage. And from I've talked to not that campaign, but other campaigns have told me that since Roe v. Wade was overturned, there's really been a significant increase in donations to Democratic campaigns. And that small donor network the Democrats have developed, especially since Trump's election in 2016, I think single women, suburban women, who were outraged and are fearful of the future with the Supreme Court and Republicans around the country passing anti-abortion rights bills. They've really stepped up to campaigns.
And it's not just the governor's race where we are seeing DFL candidates with an advantage over their Republican opponents. If we look at the AG race, Keith Ellison, the incumbent, has $573,000 of cash on hand. The Republican, Jim Schultz, only has $113,000. Doug Wardlow also has $35,000. He's challenging Schultz for the Republican nomination. Secretary of State, Also the same deal where Steve Symon, the DFL, are $679,000 on hand. Kim Crockett only about $178,000. And even if we look at the state parties, the DFL, I believe, has about $2.5 million. The Republicans, only $294,000. So I'm curious what is causing this. You were hinting that possibly it is just this network of small donors for the DFL. But I would think in a very favorable election cycle for the Republicans, they would be doing a little bit better in terms of their campaign numbers. What do you make of the DFL usually holding these big advantages in pretty much all of these races around the state? And what's causing it?
Yeah, I mean, some of it is that big donors don't have a lot of confidence. The kinds of big donors that Republicans want and need to make up some of that gap, I just don't think they have much confidence after this 15-year losing streak. They just don't have the confidence that Republicans can win a statewide race. So that's part of it. Democrats have been really the dominant fundraising player in Minnesota for a number of years. And so some of that just builds on itself. And then there's the power of incumbency. I mean, you know, if you are somebody who's got business before state government or works in a regulated industry, you don't really want to go against the incumbent. Which, and I understand none of us like the implications of that, but that's the reality. So it's a kind of combination of factors that people just are not that confident that Republicans can win here statewide, even though it does appear to be a favorable year for them.
Speaking with Patrick Coolican, editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer, make sure you go to minnesotareformer.com. Last story to briefly talk about, and this has to do with nurses at the Mayo Clinic, as 500 nurses at Mayo Clinic's Mankato Hospital decided to decertify their union with the Minnesota Nurses Association. The effort was led by Glenn Taylor's stepdaughter with help from the National Right to Work Foundation. Tell us a little bit about their efforts and how they were able to convince their nurses to decertify their union, because this was a big blow to unions in Minnesota and ends a very long relationship that this union had had over the years in terms of being around and advocating for their workers and their nurses.
Right. Mayo Clinic, at the flagship hospital in Rochester, they're not unionized, and presumably it's because they have excellent pay and benefits there. But they do have these unionized nurses at the Mankato facility, which is they've acquired, and so they were grandfathered in there. It's certainly interesting that Glenn Taylor, the Minnesota mogul billionaire, former Republican state senator, owner of the Star Tribune and the Timberwolves, that it's his stepdaughter who helped run that campaign to decertify the union. And they apparently had some sort of a organizing party at the Taylor residence. We found that to be an interesting wrinkle. I think that their argument here is that Mayo Clinic pays its nurses very well, and you can earn those wages without having to pay union dues. And the union's response, I think, properly so, is, well, if you're having trouble with burnout, which so many nurses are, you want a union there to advocate for you, especially with the issue of staffing levels. But apparently that argument did not break through.
Yeah, it was a relatively close vote as I saw the final numbers, and there are a number of nurses who aren't happy with the idea that they are decertifying. So something that we'll have to follow along as that moves ahead now, as the Mayo Clinic nurses at the Mankato Hospital will no longer be part of the Minnesota Nurses Association Union. Well, you have been speaking with Patrick Coolican. He is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. Again, go to minnesotareformer.com for the great journalism and the latest in Minnesota news and politics. Patrick, as always, thanks for the time today.
Good to be here.
Let's take a break and send things back over to Matt McNeil on AM 950.